How was Bitten so far?
Wonderful.
Hello? Yes? Move this way? Which way? Like this? Stand
equal,
like this.
Equal rights.
Stand okay. Like this, exactly like this. Did Elio use the mic? He did not use the mic.
We didn't, but it's okay.
No. Okay.
There was a Muna.
It's also not
he used a Muna.
Easier if you put it.
No, I'm going to hold it. Thank you. Right. Hello, everybody. So how's it been so far?
Great.
It's good, yeah?
Excellent.
Yeah, you think it can get better? Impossible. Cannot get better than Eliyahu Bergstein. Is that right?
Yeah.
You may applaud, if you wish. I only said that because his wife is here. That's it. She should hear a little applause. Right? Eliyahu, correct? Yes. Yes, he's talking in the back. No talking, please. Okay. So this is a pretty exciting day for us here to come to Mansiyar HaKadosh to present some discovery program to you. And we have a hidden agenda, as some of you may have figured out. The hidden agenda is we're not trying to make you from Chas V'Shalom. That's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to convince you that what we have, the material that we have, is so powerful and has been so successful for already over 20 years or so, that we would like to turn everyone in this audience into an ambassador for Kiruv. That's what we're really trying to do. So we hook you in by saying, we're going to give you the discovery program, but really that's not what the purpose is. The purpose is we're trying to convince you, excite you, invigorate you, inspire you, do everything possible to tell you that we want to win the war. We want to win the war, not just the small battles that we are able to, Baruch Hashem, have been doing very well, and getting many, many people, Baruch Hashem, to be Mekayim Torah Mitzvahs, but we're trying to turn each and every one of you people here into an ambassador for Kiruv, and we know that it can be done, because we have already done it for thousands of people. So we know it can be done. People who have never, ever spoken to a secular Jew in their entire lives, there are people like that, are now today talking to secular Jews, and it's working. You just have to try. It's unbelievable. It's really working. There are thousands of people who have never, ever done that before. And in addition to that, there are people who claim that they don't even know a secular Jew. I don't know anybody. I look around. I don't see anybody. If you're not looking carefully enough, you have to look a little further. And you will find that they are there. There's only about 10 million of them. That's all. So they must be somewhere. And they're not all in Kansas. Because I've been there, and I could tell you they're not all in Kansas. There are a few in Kansas. But you don't have to go to Kansas or Oklahoma or Mexico City. You don't have to go there. They are much closer than you think. I know somebody who is from today, a Balchuva today, who told me, I probably should not open with this story, but he told me a long time ago that he grew up here in this neighborhood. Totally secular. Never involved. He looked around, he just watched you. He was watching you. I don't know if you were here then. It was about 15 years ago. And he was just watching, and he was amazed. Look at these people. And he told me, nobody ever approached me. Now, I'm not being Moitzi Laz on this community. Believe me, this happens in every community. And he said, Bezeh Haloshen. He said, if anyone would have approached me, if anyone would have said, come for Shabbos, I want to show you something, well, I would have been like that. So easy. As it happens, Siyata Deshmaya, he met somebody at work, and there was a very strange story, of course, like all the stories are, and it was very simple, and before you know it, it was like a breeze. But he said, I wasted all those years. Anybody would have approached me, easy. And there are countless stories like this. Again, not putting down anybody here in this audience, Chas V'Shalom, just saying it happens in every neighborhood. All we have to do is try. So, let's get on with the discovery program itself. So far you've heard about the seven wonders of Jewish history. You heard it from the eighth wonder, Rabbi Bergstein, in Jewish history. Amazing. And also you heard about the transmission, the national revelation, which as he told you, I hope he told you, I wasn't here, that is the most important part of the program. And the most compelling. That kind of MS penetrates into the neshama. It makes sense to people, and it hits them in their neshama because they were there. We know that the neshamas were there at Har Sinai. So when they hear national revelation, it's a blow away. It is so powerful. So even if you didn't get it exactly, but if you can just look into it a little more, mention it, just the idea that there's only one time in the history of mankind that the Almighty spoke to all the Jews. Only one time. And there's only one religion that ever claimed that. It's the Jewish people. Just that is so powerful. It can lead very easily to turn someone around. It is that powerful. That's how powerful it is. So I gave him all the good stuff. I gave Rabbi Bergstein the best things to say, the most important things to say. That's because he begged me all week. He said, let me do revelation. We fought back and forth and back. Finally, I let him do it. Okay, I hope he did a good job. So now I'm going to give you the unimportant stuff, not really, but also interesting parts that you can relate to other people. Okay, let's talk about the alternative to a God-given Torah. Let's say they're right. Nobody argues that there is a Torah. You go to the shelf, you see it. You open the ark, it's there. Somebody wrote it. Okay, but they say, who wrote it? Well, it couldn't have been God. It must have been somebody else. Or a group of people. Or maybe aliens. Or monkeys. Or who knows what. Anybody except God. That's their argument. Okay. So if somebody wants to argue that these books, the five books of Moses, that these books were written or given by somebody else, don't attack them. Say, let's say, okay, maybe it's possible. Let's see if that works. So appeal to someone on their level. Say, let's see if it works. Let us pretend that they are right. Just for a moment, I know it sounds a little dangerous. Don't try this experiment at home, as they say. It's a little dangerous to say maybe they're right. But just for the purpose of this discussion this morning, let's pretend they're right. There is no God. God didn't write a Torah. It was given by some other people. We don't know who it was. Rabbi Bergstein may have suggested King Josiah or Ezra or who knows who. Maybe some other people, a group got together somewhere in the desert. They wanted to give the Jewish people a nice book, a law book, a history book. They got the people together and they wrote it. Possible. Okay. Let's see if it makes sense. So in order to do that, what I'd like to do now is turn this audience into the committee to write the Bible. Let's pretend that we are those people. We're the people, we're going to get together, we're going to decide, you know, the Jewish people, they need an instruction book. Everything needs an instruction book. You buy a watch today, you get an instruction book this thick. You know, most of it are in foreign languages, you can't read. It's not that difficult to watch, you know, you put it on, you, not that hard. So life might also need an instruction book. That would make sense. The Jewish people, they need an instruction manual. That makes sense. So let's give them one. So the people got together. Let's say it's you. And you decided, let's write a book for them. Let's write an instruction book for them. We'll give them a little history. We'll throw in a few stories to make it interesting. But primarily, it is a law book. Teach them how to live. Makes sense. Now, of course, we're not going to tell anybody that we wrote it. Because people are not really going to listen to it if we wrote it. You know, if I give you a few laws, why should you listen to me, right? You look like very nice people. Some of you are probably intelligent, I would assume. But why should they listen to your laws? So you're going to write it, but you're going to tell everybody that God wrote it. That's the way. That's what they're saying. That's what they're saying. People wrote it, somehow it got here, and those people told, explained, somehow assumed, and told people that this was God's book. Okay, let's see if it makes sense. If it makes sense, then maybe they're right. If it doesn't make sense, maybe we're right. So let's see if it makes sense. Let's try it out. Here we are. It's a committee of, 150 people. We're going to sit together, and we're going to write the book. We're not going to tell anybody that we're doing it. In a quiet place out in the wilderness, Muncie, New York, nobody comes here, no one ever heard of this place. We're going to write this law book, and then everybody's going to look at it, and they're going to say, wow, look what God gave us. That's how we're going to write it. Ready? So what I'm going to ask you to do now is, I'll be the chairman of the committee. I have the microphone that makes me the chairman, okay? And we're going to entertain ideas, what we should put in the book. So pretend there is no book, no Torah, no five books, no six books, nothing. There's nothing here. We're going to write it from scratch right now. It's a couple of thousand years ago. Okay, we know that the Bible, as he explained to you, is at least 2,400 years old. That's when the Septuagint was written, the Greek translation. We know that in history. We'll tell you it's 1,000 years older than that. It's 3,320 years old. We know that from our Torah. However, we're going to pretend that we're writing. We're going to write it. We're going to pretend that he gave it. So it's a couple of thousand years ago. We're about to write the book. Let's see if it makes sense. Somebody here, give me a law. Remember, there is no Torah now. Give me a law that you would want to put in the book. A law that you think the Jewish people should follow. Sir?
Don't eat chicken feet.
Don't eat chicken feet. This is an excellent idea. I don't know how you got on the committee, sir. Check your qualifications. Okay. Your first name?
Hertzke.
Hertzke. That's your first name?
Yes.
Good. Hertzke suggested, we're going to put it up to a vote, I'm sorry. Don't eat chicken feet. How many people
can
like
give
that?
My reasons?
No. That's not how the committee works. Remember, I have the microphone. It did not make it into the book. I'm sorry. We took a vote. No one voted for it. Anyone else? Another law do you want to put in the book? Yes, sir.
You should not commit murder.
Do not commit murder. Your first name, sir?
Steve.
Steve says do not commit murder. How many like that? Do not commit murder. Ooh, that made it. That's in. Steve, you're a published author. How does it feel? Nice. Nice. Do not commit murder. All right. Anybody else? Another law you want to put?
No,
yes.
No taxes.
No taxes. You know what? I tell you something. I tell you something. Yeah. I'm not going to vote on it because I'm afraid it'll pass. So we're going to change the rules. Again, with the microphone. We're going to change the rules. We're not going to vote on everything. We need taxes. We need taxes. Yes, even taxes and terror. So, somebody else. Yes.
Should not steal.
Do not steal. First name?
Rini.
Rini says do not steal. How many people like do not steal? In the book. Now, this is a possibility. This is a possibility. Maybe this is the way it happened. Maybe this is the way it happened. People got together. They put some laws together. Whatever they thought was a good idea, chicken feet notwithstanding, they put the laws together and they said, whatever makes sense, we put in. Whatever doesn't make sense is not put in. Very reasonable. Okay, now, I would like to suggest a law. Okay? And you tell me if you think this is a good law, we're going to vote on it also. Okay? If it makes it, if you like it, we put it in. If you don't like it, we leave it out. Simple. And if it makes sense, by the way, then it's possible that they are right. It could have happened this way. But if it doesn't make sense, they are in big trouble. So here's my law. I'd like to suggest that since we generally are an agricultural society, we should have agricultural laws. And by that mean, I suggest that we should put a law in our book that tells the people that they can only work their land for 6 years. 6 consecutive years they could work their land, but in the 7th year they should stop. Let them stop for an entire year. No plowing, no seeding, no pruning, no harvesting. Don't touch the land for an entire year. And let's see what happens. 8th year again, we start up again brand new, perfectly fine. But let's make it a law. It's not a choice. It's a law. People have to do that. 6 years they work the land, 7th year they stop. That's it. Now, there may be some advantages, some disadvantages to this law. Somebody tell me, what is an advantage to this law? What do you like about this law before you vote on it? What do you like about this law? Yes?
Ecologically, it makes sense to not destroy the land and let it replenish itself.
Ah, very good. Very good. Let's take a look at the, let's see what happens here. Good. Soil replenishment. Okay? See? You read the notes here before you came in early. Very good. Soil replenishment tells us that, as we know, ecologically, which is a very fancy word, ecologically means that we want the soil to replenish itself. We leave it alone, the minerals come back, they return, and then we get a better crop again. If we just keep working the land every year, we're going to ruin the land, we're going to waste the land, we're going to overuse the land. I happen to know a lot about this. I live in Brooklyn, And I know a lot about farming on Ocean Parkway. You don't have to know too much to know that this is obviously a good idea. We want the soil to replenish itself. Excellent. Okay? Your first name?
Khani.
But and anybody think it's a bad idea? What's bad about this idea? Telling people to stop for a year. What's bad about this idea, sir?
It won't be
food to
eat, so I would suggest that...
Won't be food. Don't. See, when you come to a Jewish audience, you always want to do extra. You know, it's excellent, excellent. So I like the way you did it also, you know. There won't be any food to eat, but I just want to suggest... It was like the Helamachas, you know, it was like, you know. So, your first thing?
Chaim
says, it's a good idea, it's a bad idea, it's a problem. It's a problem. It's a problem. There's no food to eat. No food to eat. So it's a good idea, soil replenishment, okay? It's a bad idea because there's no food to eat. Somebody here, you understand the problem? So I have a nice law, we got a problem. It's good, but it's bad. So I'd like to put the law in the book. Somebody here perhaps can suggest what it is we could do to solve this problem. Yes, Chaim?
Just the states.
See, I'm calling you right away.
7 states.
Well, you don't have to do all at once. We can divide up the land. Okay? Take a look here. We could also store the crops. Somebody's going to suggest that. You could store up for the... Or you could divide the land. Excellent. Divide it up into different times. You see, you're also a published author. Right? So it's a very nice idea. We want to put the land, to put the law in the book. We want to tell people to stop working in the seventh year. We have a little problem that we have nothing to eat. That could be a problem. Okay? And especially for the Jewish people. And therefore, we have some solutions. Store up some crops. Divide up the land. By the way, it's a very interesting thing I have to tell you. Is that when I ask audiences sometimes, secular audiences, I say, what's the problem with this law? So anywhere we go throughout the world, everybody says the same thing. Everybody always says, I'm not going to have anything to eat. I'm going to starve. There's only one place that doesn't give that answer. New York City. If we give it in Manhattan, they never say we have nothing to eat. They always say, it's bad for business. The economy will suffer. Now they might say, what about the fact that we have nothing to eat? It's also a problem. It's also a problem. But getting back to the economy... But Gevengler, people tell us there's nothing to eat, so we have to solve the problem, and we do. How do we solve it? Either store up the crops or divide the land. Does anybody not understand that in this audience? Is that very clear? You see what just happened? So far, they're right. This could have happened this way. I make a suggestion, put a law into the book. It's a good idea, but there's a bad idea. We solve the problem. We tell the people to store the crops or divide up the land. We can put the law in the book. Everything's great. Glatt, beautiful. We wrote it. No problem. No God, nothing. Leave him out of it. Great. There's only one little knitch to this. And that is that I would like to suggest a different solution to this problem. Let's forget storing up the crops. Let's forget dividing the land into different sectors, and let's forget all that. Let's do a totally different solution to this problem. Let's tell the people in the book that they don't have to worry that there's no food to eat. Because by the time the sixth year comes around, God is going to give them a triple crop. You need a triple crop the sixth year. The seventh year, because you haven't harvested anything. The eighth year, because you didn't plant anything in the seventh year. So let's just tell the people, we're going to write in our book, we're going to write that you don't have to worry about starving. You don't have to worry about it. We are going to guarantee them that God will give them a triple crop. Take a look at the book. It says so here, all these tremendous crops that we're going to give them. Look at these delicious bananas and the face of us. We're going to give them a triple crop in the sixth year. Take a look. It says it in the book. This law actually made it to the book. For 6 years, you may plant your fields, prune your vineyards, harvest your crops, but the seventh year is a Sabbath of Sabbaths for the land. It is God's Sabbath, during which you may not plant your fields nor prune your vineyards. And then the Torah anticipated this problem, because we wrote it, right? We wrote it, So we wrote the problem, and we wrote, and if you ask, what will we eat? The author did not live in Manhattan. And if you ask, what will we eat in the seventh year? We have not planted, nor we harvested crops. What is our solution that we wrote? I will direct my blessing to you in the sixth year, and the land will produce enough crops for 3 years. What should it have said over here? Instead of giving this solution, what should it have said?
Store
the crops. Divide the land. Simple. What's wrong with this solution, by the way?
How are you going to affect it?
How are you going to affect it, Steve? You're on the committee. That's what you wrote. Would you have written this, Steve?
Well, no, I was absent at the edit.
Always a problem in Muncie. I told you, I haven't come to Muncie anymore.
No, you can't make it come.
He's absent.
They're going to abandon the region.
Yeah.
They're going to abandon the region.
That's it. What? I mean, how could you, committee, how could you have written this? Can you guarantee this is going to happen? How absurd. Could you get a more ridiculous answer to a problem? How absurd. How long do you think this religion is likely to last?
7 years.
What?
6 years.
Yeah. You're basically looking at a six-year religion. As soon as the sixth year comes and we don't get the triple crop, who wrote this book? What's good? This is the basis of our religion? When this doesn't happen, we're finished. They close the book, they throw it out, there's nothing left. Maybe the religion lasts 13 years. Maybe we give it an additional cycle. You know, the Jews are long-suffering. You know, so we suffer a little bit, you know. We'll try it another. Maybe we've miscalculated. We'll try one more. But this is not our solution. If human beings were writing this book, that's the last thing they would write. Do you see that? We can't guarantee that God's going to do anything. That's what we're telling them to do. It's an extremely powerful argument. Extremely powerful. It shows us and shows everyone that it can't be human beings. It can't be people who are writing this. People don't write these things. Especially when there are easy ways to solve it. Store the crops. Divide the land. Yeah.
Maybe they could put this in the book and then rabbinically establish a heter mechira at the same time.
Maybe they can put it in the book and establish a rabbinic heter mechira at the same time. We'll discuss that at the next break. You know, but, you know, intuitively it's a big mistake, obviously. Right? Yeah, everybody see that? Very simple, very obvious, and very powerful. Let's take a look from this into some of the actual food that is grown and see something else about what we call ID info, identifying information. This is God's imprint on the Torah. His signature in the Torah that tells us and shows us that it must have been him. There is no denying it. When you see this, you say, it can't be anyone else. Can't be a human being. What else? What else can we show for that? What makes an animal kosher? Anybody know? What, if you want to eat something, want to eat a nice piece of meat or something, what is it that makes an animal kosher? What does the Bible tell us? Okay, split hooves and choose its cut for whatever reason. Okay, on that basis, let's see what we got here. Is a cow kosher? Let me see, how's he doing there? And chewing the cud, pretty good. Oh, okay. Is that one of the signs for kosher animals? No, that's a different kind of sign. It also helps, but that's not a sign of a kosher animal. He has to chew its cud and have split feet. Anybody see the split feet? For whatever reason, the Torah tells us those are the signs of kosher animals. Let's say it has only one sign. Kosher?
No.
Choose a cud? Just choose a cud? No. Just split the feet? No. Okay? On that basis, it has to have both of them. Is a lion kosher? Anybody know?
No.
Why not? Doesn't? Either one. Correct. It has neither sign. Correct. How about a horse? Horse kosher?
Doesn't.
Doesn't have either sign. Does not chew its cud. Does not split hooves. Thank you very much. Okay, so obviously these are not kosher animals. Okay? However, if we find an animal that has only one kosher sign, the Torah tells us that that is also not kosher. We need two. Doesn't explain why. So we call a chayk. Doesn't explain why. But that's what it says. Let's take a look at all the animals in the world and see what the Torah has to say about kosher animals. And here it says, very clearly, God spoke to Moses and Aaron, telling them to speak to the Israelites and convey the following to them. Of all the animals, this is in Parshas Shemini, of course, of all the animals in the world, these are the ones you may eat. Really? Fascinating. These are the ones you may eat. Among mammals, you may eat anyone that has true hooves that are cloven, meaning split, and that chews its cud. Now, if I was the author of this book as a human being, and I wanted to write the kosher laws, now, for whatever reason, I had this idea about split hooves and chews its cud. I don't know why I thought it. That's what I wanted to do. What I would do, I think, is that I would write it exactly like this. Maybe I wouldn't use the word cloven. Maybe people, you know, the art school would have a little problem with that. Wouldn't use, maybe I'd use the word split, but it doesn't matter. This is basically what I would say. Of all the animals in the world, these are the ones you may eat. Any mammal that has cloven hooves and chews its cud. Period. Finished. Gegangen. I'm done. It's clear. There's no problem at all. I don't have to explain why. I want to explain. I don't want to explain. But these are the two kosher signs. Finished. But for some reason, the author of this book chose to continue. Didn't stop at this. He chose to continue. And now, we're totally confused. I was clear at this point. Watch what he says. Of the cud-chewing animals and the hoofed animals, these are the only ones you may not eat. And now, the Torah is going to tell us four animals that have one kosher sign. First one, the camel, shall be unclean to you, although it chews its cud, does not have a cloven hoof. The shafan, same thing, chews its cud, does not have a cloven hoof. The arneves, same thing, chews its cud, does not have a cloven hoof. And finally, the pig, as we all know, unclean to you, although it has a cloven hoof, since it does not chew its cud. What's going on here? What is the author trying to tell us? The author is trying to say that every animal you want to kosher has to have two kosher signs. But let me just tell you something here, folks. There are four, and only four, species of mammal that have one kosher sign. The first three are all cud chewers. Shafan, arneves, we don't even know what they are today. They're probably extinct animals. But these three animals are all cud chewers, but they don't have split hooves, can't eat them. And the only animal in the entire world that is not a cud chewer, but does have split feet, is the pig. Strange. Why would the Torah have a need to tell us this? If I was the author, would I say something like this? If this is a couple of thousands of years ago, when I certainly don't know all the mammals in the world, why would I limit myself to say that there's only one animal in the whole world that has split feet and doesn't chew its cud? Who knows? Now it's 2010, now we've traveled all over the world, now we found everything. Maybe there's going to be another one. Take a look. Here's the simple chart for all of you in case you didn't get it the first time. Has split hooves and chews its cud? Obviously kosher. It has no split hooves, doesn't chew its cud? Obviously not kosher. And if it has only one, then we have just the camel, the gomel, the arneves, the shafan. Those are all cud chewers. Do not chew its cud. Do not have split hooves. And there's only one animal in the entire world, just the pig. How would you write something like this, knowing full well that we have no idea what the future will bring? So number one, it's a tremendous risk, whoever the author is. If we assume this author is not the creator of the world, why would a human author make a claim that he knows he is not sure about? Why would he make a claim that that's the only animal? He knows that there's so many other animals in the world. How much of the world did they see a few thousand years ago? They're going to know it. They looked around. They said, oh, they only see the pig. All right, I'll write it down. Why? Why write it down? What a tremendous gamble. And number two, guess what? The author was correct. Today, we have identified, we've classified over 5,000 different species of mammal. There is no other mammal in the entire world that has split hooves and does not chew its cud except the pig. There is no other animal like that. So not only was the author not taking a gamble, he was actually right a few thousand years ago. Now we know everything, of course. one of the biggest problems we have, by the way. We know everything today. Sure, everything. What don't we know? We also know there's no other animal like the pig. Number one, why would the author make such a risky chance at writing such a terrible gamble, knowing full well that we don't know what the future is going to bring? And number two, how could he have been right? How could he have been exactly right? There is no other animal except the pig like that. Very powerful argument. Number two, which you don't see over here, but is also regarding fish, is the same issue. Fish is almost more interesting, frankly. What makes a fish kosher?
Fins and scales.
I'm a big fish fan. I love to eat the fish, actually, not to identify them. But I love fish, and fins and scales make a kosher fish. The Torah says so very clearly. You need to have fins and you need to have scales. Now, let's say you have only one of them. Let's say you have a fish that only has fins. Is it kosher?
No.
No. Let's say you have a fish that only has scales. Kosher?
No.
That's a tricky question. Because according to the Mishnah in Nida, Perek Dalet in Nida, the Mishnah tells us a very startling fact. Now, this will show you that not only is there information like this in the Torah Sheh Bichsav, but even in the Torah Sheh Baal Peh, there's information that no human being could have written. Because the Mishnah says very clearly that there is no such thing in the world as a fish that only has scales. You'll find fish with scales and fins, yes. You'll find fish with no scales and no fins, yes. You'll find fish with fins and no scales, yes. But you will never find a fish with scales without fins. Guess what? Today we have classified over 40,000 major classifications of fish. There are actually over 1 million minor. You ever been to the aquarium? There's endless minor, over 1 million minor classifications of fish. They're still looking for that fish that has scales without fins. They haven't found it yet. You know what? They never will. You know why? Mishnah said so. Doesn't exist. Scales, no fins, doesn't exist. Now that's unbelievable. Why would Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, 1,800 years ago, make a statement like that? Where did he get that from? Doesn't that sound a little risky to you? You'll never find a fish with scales. How did he know that? What did he do? He went deep sea diving with Jacques Cousteau's great-great-grandfather. He put on the snorkel gear. He went around the world. Well, what do you think he did, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi? Where did he get that from? He took a tremendous risk. No, he didn't. He knew it. It's called Mesira. He got it from his Rebbe, he got it from his Rebbe, he got it from his Rebbe. So he knows it's true. And guess what? Today it is 1,800 years ago, 1,800 years later, it's still true. Fins and scales, yes. No fins, no scales, yes. Fins, no scales, yes. Scales, no fins? No. No. Just don't find it. How did he know? So the identifying information is not only in the Torah Sheh Bichsav, but even in the oral law, even in Torah Sheh Baal Peh, which is 1,500 years after Har Sinai. But even in there, we could show you things that show you that this was written Beruach HaKodesh. This is not written by just a human being. This is given to us from Har Sinai, passed down. How powerful is that? Okay, let's move on to the final section of the discovery program, and we're going to see if we can. Ah, that worked very well, Rabbi Bergstein. Look at this. Don't these look exciting? Except that you've seen them already. Ha! Look at this. Fantastic. Okay, let's move on to the final section of the program. Even though the national revelation, as Rabbi Bergson told you, is clearly the most important and most compelling piece of information that you can ever learn or teach to a secular Jew, there's nothing more important than saying to them that the Jews are the only religion that ever claimed that God spoke to them. If you want to wrap it up in one sentence, that's it. Just ask them, how many religions have ever claimed that God spoke to them? The answer is one. Now go home and think about it. I mean, if you have 30 seconds online at the supermarket, and you want to give somebody a 30-second kiruv, that's what I would tell them. Somebody said, okay, I'll give you 30 seconds. What do you got? And I'd say, how many people, how many religions have ever claimed God spoke to them? I don't know. Answer, one. Go home and think about it. If people really want to do it, that's really in one sense. Most important thing you could ever tell anybody. Now, although that is the most important thing, what I'm about to show you now, if you've never seen it before, and probably at least there's some of you have seen this before, this is the one thing that you're going to be more likely to repeat to your friends and to anybody else, because it's just so interesting that you can't help repeating it to somebody else once you see it. And many of you have already seen it already, maybe you've already repeated it, but it's good to chazer over again. Okay, and this, we're going back to my favorite yontif of the year, which of course is Purim. I'm still a child at heart, and Purim is the greatest day, and Yom Kippurim, as we know, so Purim has tremendous Kedusha, and everything we tell all secular audiences, everything that happened in this amazing story, which was 2,400 years ago, everything that happened in this story is written down in a book, and the name of the book is Megillas Esther. Yeah, people have heard the Book of Esther, this and that. Yeah, you've heard of it, they heard something about Esther. I think I know somebody named Esther. Oh, yeah, yeah. Very nice, okay? And in this book are all the details of one of the greatest miracles in the history of the Jewish people, how the Jewish people were saved from the Persians, and there were amazing stories, etc., and tremendous miracles, wonderful, all written down in the book. Then I asked them, you know, the name of the book is Megillas Esther. I said, oh, I know somebody named Esther. Oh, you do know somebody named Esther. Oh, very interesting. Tell me, do you know what the name Esther means? What does Esther mean? I don't know. Names have meaning. Yeah, names have meaning. What does Esther mean?
Hidden,
right, from the word seser, right? Comes from a root word meaning concealed or hidden, right? By the word, what does the word Megillah mean? Megillas Esther?
Revealed.
Ah, Megillah comes from the word gilui, legalos, to reveal. Megillas Esther actually means to reveal the hidden. Fantastic, right? So Megillas Esther is not just the Book of Esther. Megillah, it's a scroll. No, it's not. It's a book. No, it's not. It means to reveal something. Megillas Esther is revealing something that is concealed. So in that book, all of the miracles that happened to the Jewish people at that time were concealed. Everything was hidden. Everything worked in very mysterious ways, as we know, which they don't know, but as we know very well. And the point of the book is to reveal some of those hidden miracles. So now we're going to reveal to you, in the next few minutes, we're going to reveal something that has been hiding in the Book of Esther for the last 2,000 years. We're going to reveal it. It's not our chiddush, it's something actually which was, quote, discovered by the Belzer Rebbe about 40 years ago, actually. We don't usually give him credit because we're usually in a secular audience, and when we say the Belzer Rebbe, they go, huh? We have no idea, but we say the Belzer Rebbe here. We hope that you have at least some connection and some idea that we're talking about a great man. And this is something that he was Mechadish and was put into the discovery program. 2,400 years ago, there was a miracle to the Jewish people. All the facts were written down in this book. All the details of the story, everything was written down in this book. But there is one thing about this book that is different from any other book in the entire scriptures. You explain that there are 24 books of the scriptures. There are 5 books of Moses, and then there's the prophets and the writings, the 24 books of the scriptures. This is one of them. But this book is unique. There's something about this book that you won't find in any other book in the entire scriptures. Anybody here know what that is?
God's name is
correct, Herzke. God's name is not in there. Now, when you tell this to somebody, they go, I'm a little bit surprised. Everybody can relate that there's something unusual about that. This is actually a book of the Bible. I mean, God's name, how long is it? You know, a page? No, it's 10 chapters. 10 chapters? Where's God's name? It's not there. What? What, they left it out? They forgot? They took it out? But what do you mean God's name is not there? So you say, oh, that's a good question. Always tell them, it's a good question. Everything's a good question. If they're asking, it's Shengit. It's a good question. What do you mean it's not there? He says, you know, you're asking a question that the Talmud asked. Ooh, really? What's the Talmud? You're asking a very good question. What does that mean, God's name is not there? So the Talmud answers, you say, tell them that the Talmud tells us that God's name is there. Ah, but it's hiding. Everything else is hidden. The whole book is full of hidden material, hidden miracles, hidden facts. Even God's name is hiding. So when Esther put this book together, the whole book, she took God's name, she put it in there, but she also hid it. Oh, that sounds intriguing. Really? She says, where is it? Where is it hiding? So there are several places where it's hiding. I'll tell you one of the places. One of the places is that there are many ways to refer to the king at that time. The king at that time, just tell them the king's name is Ahasuerus. If they laugh, that's okay. Ahasuerus was the name of the king. Don't ask them to repeat it. They won't be able to say the name. Don't worry about it. Ahasuerus. Now, many names, if you want to refer to the king, you could say many things. You could say HaMelech Ahasuerus, King Ahasuerus. You could just say Ahasuerus. That's his name. Or you could just say HaMelech, the king. We know who we're talking about. You want to refer to the president? You say President Obama. Or Obama, or the president, we know who we're talking about. So the Megillah is a very interesting book. Sometimes it says HaMelech Ahasuerus, and sometimes it just says Ahasuerus, and sometimes it just says HaMelech. It just says the king. So our scholars tell us that when it just says the king, just says HaMelech, that's not only a reference to Ahasuerus, that means the king of the universe. That's where God's name is hiding. They look at you and they go, all right, okay. So now, that's an interesting explanation, but let's see if we could trip up that explanation and find even a more interesting question. That's what's going to happen now. So for this, we're going to take a look at the 9th chapter, chapter 9, Perek Tes, chapter 9, one of the most famous portions of the whole Megillah. And here is written to you exactly the way it is written in every Megillah that has ever been written in the history of mankind. They are all been written exactly the same in the last 2,400 years. It's all written exactly like that. You tell them, explain that it was written on parchment. Scribes write it on parchment with a special ink, a special paper, and etc., and a special script. And everyone is copied from another one, and they're all written the same way, and they're all exactly, it's been given down, transmitted perfectly for 2,400 years, exactly the way it's been. This is the way it looks. Okay? Now, in order for anybody to understand it, you can't just show them this because they don't understand it, so we have to show it to them in English. So we set it up in English for them, and here it is. Take a look at the English, exactly how it looks, and you will see, if you've never seen it before, something shocking, if you've seen it before, please don't whisper to your neighbor, oh, wait till you see this. Don't do that, okay? You're going to ruin it for them. You know, it's very exciting. And the Jews struck at all their enemies with the sword, and slaughtered, destroyed, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. And in Shushan, the capital, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men, including Parshan Dasan, Dalfan, and Aspatan, Paratan, Adalian, and Redatan, Parmashan, Risa, Rita, Vizita, and sons of Haman, son of Hamdasa, enemy of the Jews, but they did not lay their hands on the spoils. You don't have to do it in Neshima Achas like I did. You could say it separately. You see the 10 not sons of Haman. And just ask the following question. What happened over here? Shushan, the capital, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men, including these 10 men who are the 10 sons of Haman, of Haman, right? Now, is it clear? Are the 10 sons of Haman dead? Clear, right? There's no question about it. They slew and destroyed 500 men, including the 10 sons of Haman. We have the names, etc. Everything's fine, clear, wonderful, right? Okay, let's look down a little further and see what happens now. You look down a little further and you see the conversation is going on between Esther and the king. What is Esther saying? The same day, the number of those killed in Shushan, the capital, was reported to the king. The king said to the queen Esther, in Shushan, the capital, the Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men, including the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? What is your request now? It shall be granted to you. What is your petition further? It shall be fulfilled. Okay? Ahasuerus is extending his hand to Esther. Says, listen, whatever you want. Let me reach in here and say, Platinum American Express card. You can take it out and go on a shopping spree. You can get clothes and jewels and furs and boats and the provinces, echveisvos, anything that you want. Imagine it's a woman's dream. Anything you want. Wow. So what do you think she asks for? So what does she want? Here's her answer. A little surprising. Her answer is, Esther replied, if it pleases the king, allow the Jews of Shushan to do tomorrow as they have done today, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. Wait a minute. Did we get that right? Is that really what she said? She could have asked for anything. That's what she asked for? What's wrong with her request? What's wrong? What's the problem? They're dead. These people are dead. She wants him to hang dead people? That's what she asked for? Maybe. It seems like that. That's number one problem. Number two problem, we just told you that when it says HaMelech, when it says the king, it refers also to God. I mean, she's asking God to hang 10 dead men? If it pleases the king. What? How's that supposed to happen? The big hand comes out one day from the Shemayim, picks up the 10 men. What's going on? Hang dead people. God's supposed to hang the dead people. That's the answer to anything that she could have. Do tomorrow as they have done today. What possibly could she have meant? So here is a possible explanation. New York Times. October 16th, 1946. This is right after the Nuremberg trials. Göring ends life by poison. 10 others hanged in Nuremberg prison for Nazi war crimes. Doomed men on gallows. Pray for Germany. Do tomorrow as they have done today. How many Nazis were hanged at Nuremberg?
Ten.
What happened to the 11th Nazi?
Killed.
Committed suicide. How many sons did Haman have?
Ten.
What happened to them? They were hanged. Did anybody here know about an 11th child that Haman had?
A daughter.
Interesting. It's an interesting story because throughout the world, and I have never, ever, ever seen anything but this, throughout the world, if you ask anyone, tell me a story about Haman's daughter, we only basically know one story about his daughter. And that is, she was waiting for Haman to be regaled in the streets of Shushan at the big parade. You all know the story. And instead of Mordechai leading Haman on the horse through Shushan, instead it's the opposite. Haman was found to be in disfavor with the king. He's leading Mordechai on the horse. She doesn't know this. She has a little chamber pot waiting for him in her apartment there. She looks down, pushes over the pot. Her father looks up. She sees that she's about to disgrace her own father. She jumps and commits suicide. Well, that's interesting. 10 sons of Haman are hanged. The 11th commits suicide. 10 Nazis are hanged. The 11th commits suicide. By the way, Göring, the 11th Nazi who committed suicide, do you know that he was found, there's a book about him, that he was found that he wore actually women's clothes under his Nazi uniform. Strange. Do tomorrow as they have done today. Let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. So some people look at this and they go, that's interesting. Maybe it's a coincidence. So what's your answer? Maybe. But we go further. And it becomes less and less of a coincidence. Take a look at the picture here. This picture here is a courtroom photo from the Times of Nazi war crimes trial in Nuremberg, Germany. Though the trial ended in June 1946, sentencing was repeatedly postponed due to appeals for amnesty. I remember when I first learned about this about 20 years ago or so, a little more. It was just amazing to me. I wasn't born in 1946, but I read that. I said, I don't really understand what happened here. There are appeals for amnesty. There are Nuremberg trials. They put the Nazis on trial. They convict them, and after the convictions, they say, let's let them go. Amnesty? Let them go? Well, what was the whole point of the trial? Find them guilty and let them go? I didn't really understand that. So hold that in your pocket for a minute, because when I come back to it, you're going to see something amazing. Okay? Take a look at that. So let's take a look at a calendar. Okay? You'll need to explain to a secular Jew, if you're going to go through this,
going to explain to them that there are no numerals in the Hebrew language. There's no 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's Aleph, Beis, Gimel, and that's it. You want to say 1, you say Aleph. You want to say 2, you say Beis. You want to say 3, you say Gimel, that's it. The year of the hangings in Nuremberg, this is the year of 1946, October 16th, 1946. That year was the year 5707. In Hebrew, we call it Tavshin Zayin. Tavshin Zayin was the year of the hangings at Nuremberg. Why is that significant? Why would we be wasting your precious time here on a beautiful Sunday morning, beautiful, sunny, beautiful Sunday morning in Muncie, New York? Why are we wasting your time showing you old calendars from the butcher that we picked up from 5707? And why is that relevant? Why are the three letters, Tav, Shin, Zayin, so important to us? You know why? I'll tell you why. Because we're going to look back at the Megillah now, and we're going to see that from all the letters in Haman's son's names, there are only three letters that are written extremely small. The first one is in the first word, that is a tav. Second one is in the seventh name, that is a